while I was at Ambassador, Dr. Ward, the then president, encouraged the students to learn their Bibles, but not necessarily memorizing everything, but to write down what was going on in each chapter, make notes in a study Bible or a notebook, in which you can go through the Bible chapter by chapter, and then for each chapter, note the major themes, major characters, and personalities, as well as anything that stands out to you, whether it's, you know, doctrine, prophecy, Christian living, that sort of stuff. So just in chapter 9, as a preface, the major themes that I gleaned out of chapter 9, and I'm not saying this is a comprehensive list, but this is the ones I came up with. One is be fruitful and multiply. The second is the change in nature of animals that was done by God. The importance of life and what's contained in the life blood. That's the third one. Chapter 9 contains the fourth one here, which is the Noahian covenant, which was started with Noah and his family. There's also a concept here we'll get to when we get to that verse, but also the importance of the phrase in the cloud. David Graeby gave a sermon a while back on that. We'll touch on that as well. Another major theme, number 6, is the curse of Canaan. And the last one, major theme in this chapter is the death of Noah. I wrote Moses in my notes. I don't know why, but it's Noah. The major characters involved in this chapter are obviously God. And every reference, I think there's 4 or 5 references to God in this chapter, and it's Elohim at every reference. Noah, his 3 sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, and the grandson, Canaan. Now, before we actually get into the chapter, I thought it would be a good rehearsal to go back and get some background information to order to make Genesis 9 be more fluid. And that's a little flood pun for you there. Okay, so it'll flow a little better. Now, I dug out some old notes that I had, and I thought this was some extremely fascinating stuff. Because whenever we look at the ark, whether it's on a poster, in a book, or even a toy, we always have a misconception of the actual dimensions and the size. Now, we read about the dimensions and the size, but I'm not sure how often we actually wrap our minds around these numbers. So as the Bible describes for us that, and we're going to talk in feet, but we'll talk about the measurements. It says the length of the ark was 300 cubits by 50 cubits wide by 30 cubits high. So in the assumption here is an 18-inch cubit. So let's put that into numbers or that we're more familiar with, feet. So 300 cubits is 450 feet. 50 cubits wide is 75 feet. And 30 cubits high is 45 feet. So 450 feet long, 75 feet wide, 45 feet high. So what's interesting is the carrying capacity of the ark then has been calculated to be that of an ocean liner. In cubic capacity, it had the equivalent of being able to store what we would know today as 522 American Railroad stock cars. 522. So 42,900 cubic meters, if you do the math on cubic meters there. I won't give you those numbers, but it works out to that. And it's 1,518,750 cubic feet. So it's not a small by any stretch. In square feet, it's around 33, almost 34,000 feet, so, you know, the house is 3,000. Joe and Ben's house around 1,500, so it gives you an idea of how large it was. So how did Noah get, so a question arises, how did Noah still get all these animals on the ark? Well, it says a standard American stock car can transport 240 sheep. So that ark would have carried, if you do the math, filling it all with sheep, would have been 125,000 sheep. And interestingly enough, the average dry land animal is considerably smaller than a sheep. The ark had to transport only land animals, of course, so the mammals, birds, and reptiles were essentially all that needed accommodation, and the ark was constructed in 3 stories. as the Bible describes, and each was fitted with rooms or nests. And that's Genesis 6:14 as a reference. You can go back and look at that. So evidently there was tiers of cages or stalls to store the different types of animals. Now God specifically instructed Noah to select one pair of every kind of unclean animal and seven pairs of every kind, and kind is in brackets in my notes here, of every clean animal. Genesis 7:2 is a reference. The Bible term kind refers generally to a group of creatures, all of which can interbreed. The horse kind could be represented, therefore, by one pair of animals having the genetic potential to produce, after the flood, all varieties that we have today. The same would be true for dogs, cats, etc. The genus kind is undoubtedly a more flexible term than biological species. However, even assuming they are the same, there are not very many species of mammals, birds, amphibians, and reptiles. There was a biologist, a famous one, his name was Ernst Mayr, and he gives the number roughly of all the species in the round, kind around 17,600. Okay, so now consider this. Only 40% of the animal kingdom lives on land. And of that 40%, 70% of all those are insects. The remaining 30% of the terrestrial animal kingdom are a mean average the size, believe it or not, of a rhesus monkey. Not very large at all. Most animals can be contained in a small confinement for long periods and remain healthy. And a rhesus monkey, for example, can be maintained in a cage that's about 3 foot by 3 foot by 3 foot. So 3 foot high, 3 foot wide, 3 foot deep. So if there were 40,000 animals whose average size is that of a rhesus monkey on the ark, how much of this space would be needed? Well, without trying to bore you with numbers, only 627,600 cubic feet out of the 1.5 million cubic feet, just to give you an idea. So just a little over a third. What about insects? Remember that the Ark had a storage capacity, again, of 522 railroad freight cars. 200 cars of that 522 would have been occupied by mammals, birds, and reptiles. So that's 322 left over, giving every pair of known species of insects 16 cubic inches of space. Therefore, another 21 freight cars would have been required for the insects. That's not very many. So that gives us what? That's, where's that number again? So 221 out of the 522. So still over 300 left. So the ark was so large, it would only make sense then that the flood had to be universal. The ark was far too large only for local animals. And for that matter, if the flood were only local, an ark wouldn't have been needed at all for him to build, for Noah to build. So the animal world has, in fact, two remarkable mechanisms when we think about all the animals being on the ark. And these two remarkable mechanisms for coping with unfavorable climatic conditions, migration and hibernation. Modern biologists, despite much study, have still been unable to provide satisfactory explanations for the origin and operation of these fantastic capabilities. The known facts fit the hypothesis that God imparted these abilities, perhaps as new information conveyed to the genetic code at this time to those animals selected by him to go into the ark. Interesting point. And before the flood, it's likely that there was a worldwide pleasant climate, indicated by both the fact that the climate is implied in the fossils and sediments from practically all the so-called geologic ages. Okay, so we're starting to get a little deep here, and I'll try not to bore you too much because I want to get back into Genesis 9. So before the flood, animals probably needed no migration or hibernation, and probably all kinds of animals were dispersed more uniformly across the world. So then God would have brought them all to Noah for Noah to put them on. Now let's switch here and do a little bit of time markers. Now this is where the little spreadsheet that I printed out will come in. And just a quick, brief explanation here. The first column there where it says, first row and first column where they meet at Noah is zero. That's obviously the birth of Noah. Shem, zero. So all the zeros is when the person was actually born. And so, for example, when Shem was born, Noah was 502 years old. So if you go across when each one of those people were born, that's how old Noah was. So Noah was 892 years old when Abram was born. And so they shared 58 years together, and that's the last column. YLW means years lived with. Shem, or years lived with Noah. And so when we hit Isaac, Noah had been dead for 42 years. And when Jacob was born, Noah had been dead for 82 years. That's what the negative means. Okay, so what we're going to see here as a time marker is that Noah went into the ark, according to the Bible in Genesis 7:4, when he was 600 years old. So that makes Shem 98. Okay, and Noah is not recorded as having any children before the age of 500. Or 502 as it stands here. And the reason it's 502 is in the ESV it comments that it was around 500 years old. And to do the math to figure it out, when if Shem was 100 when he got off, 98 when he got off the ark, Noah had to be 502. So Genesis 7:11 provides a time marker. It says, in the 600th year of Noah's life, in the second month, the 17th day of the month, on that day, all the fountains of the great deep were broken up and the windows of heaven were opened. Okay, so there's the time marker. 600 year of Noah's life in the second month, the 17th day of the month. And then we know it rains for 40 days and 40 nights. And then it says in Genesis, I think it's 8 there, where it says the waters were on the earth and it took 150 days just for the waters to recede. And the waters decreased continually until the 10th month. And that is, that's Genesis 8 verse 5. No? Yeah, 8 verse 5. That's right. Sorry, 10th month. I was right. Pardon me. And Noah had the knowledge of how to keep track of the flood. So he knew exactly, just as an interesting point, Noah could actually know how to tell the months and the seasons and the days. So he knew come the 10th month. And it took just about 1 year for the waters to dry up from the face of the earth. And the number 12, according to Bollinger, which I looked up, denotes governmental perfection. Noah would be the supreme ruler of the earth at this point, and he would be administering the government of God. And maybe there's a connection there in God abolishing everyone except for Noah and his family in terms of governmental perfection. He's going to start over. Now, Genesis 8:13. Goes on to say that it came to pass in the 601st year in the first month, the first day of the month, and that is a reference to Noah's life, that time frame, that the waters were dried up from the earth, and Noah removed the covering of the ark and looked, and indeed the surface of the dry ground, the ground was dry. Interestingly enough, even at this point, Noah and his family still stayed on the ark for another 57 days. And that is on Genesis 8:14, the second month, on the 27th day from when he looked out from the first month of the first there in the previous verse. And by the way, another 57, and not that it's of any importance, but that's 3 19s if we're counting 19s. Also, the command for Noah was, now it says here, it's interesting, it says in Genesis 9, verse 1, let's read that. It said, so God, Elohim, blessed Noah and his sons and said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. The King James says, replenish the earth. Now, he says that to Noah and his sons, but we'll see in verse 19 of this same chapter that it doesn't appear, the Bible doesn't record it, so we don't have any real evidence, but it appears that Noah and his wife did not have any children post Shem, Ham, and Japheth. They're not recorded in the Bible. In the next chapter in Genesis 10, it talks about the sons of each of the three sons, but it doesn't talk about any other children. And verse 19, if you just go there real quick, it says, Genesis 9:19 says, these three were the sons of Noah, and from these the whole earth was populated, from nobody else but those three sons. Also to note is when, just before we started into verse 9, Genesis 8:20, Noah gets off the ark and he gives burnt offerings of every clean animal and every clean bird. And a burnt offering, we know, represents man's dedication to God. So there's knowledge there of the sacrificial system. There's knowledge that we're going to cover here in another verse, probably next time, in Genesis 9, 4 and 5 about the blood. So the understanding of blood paying for the sacrifice of sin. And it doesn't say that Noah and his family gave any sin offerings when they came off the ark, but we can speculate that being cooped up on cooped up on an ark for a year and a bit, chances are they probably had a few arguments here and there. And, you know, to think about that, and it's something that we often read over, but we don't really think about. And, you know, here we are, we sit here, six in this room, Joe, Ben, and the girls are five in their room. And to think that when those eight people stepped off the ark, that's it. That's all there was. No other people. So we talk about how in our scattered condition in the church, how it's somewhat difficult. I wouldn't want to say that in front of their children because they would only had rocks and sticks to play with at first. Not even animals because they wouldn't go near them at that point. But we're definitely blessed even though we have more people around us. Now, also in Genesis 9:1, and it says, back to the be fruitful and multiply. That points back to creation, in that only one family existed in Adam and Eve. The same is happening here in the sort of the family of Noah, although he has his three sons and their wives. So, and just the fact that the word Elohim is used here, it distinctly goes back to Genesis 1:2. John, that puts us at 1:30 right now. Okay, so we'll leave it at verse 1, and then we'll pick up next time. And hang on to your spreadsheet because we'll use it again because there's still some significance here I haven't touched on that I'd like to use. And hopefully